This is Kate Harness with 307 Net Radio, and today I'm joined by Police Chief Sean Bassett and Sheriff Rod Onabagh. Good evening, good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
Good.
Good, nice to see you. So it seems to be that you've had a lot of busy time recently, and drug seizures in particular have been taking up your time. What's been going on?
Well, I think Rod probably said it best, was just good old-fashioned police work. Taking a small case and maybe a small possession case and working up the ladder. And with that being said, we've been doing a lot of behind-the-scenes work, taking a lot of time with interviews, surveillance. We talked about it earlier, Cellebrite, a lot of phone dumps of information we're getting off our phones.
So before we talk about Cellebrite, mm-hmm. and I would really like to explore what that is and how it works, what kind of drug seizures are you making? What kind of drugs is it? Pot? Is it meth? Is it fentanyl?
Yes, meth and fentanyl. And we got some weed mixed mm-hmm. in there. But the majority of it is methamphetamine right now.
And is that something that's coming back? And is it coming back in large quantities? Or is this fairly small amounts? What are we really looking at the drug problem here in Johnson County?
It's coming back in large quantities at a real reduced rate.
You mean cost?
Yeah.
The amount of cost, okay.
Yeah. They're spending $50 a gram on methamphetamine now, which 6 or 8 months ago, maybe a year, was $150.
So to throw it into context for people who don't know very much about drug use, is a gram, is that a lot? Is that a little meth? I mean, is that what keeps a fairly addicted user going for a day or a month, or what are we talking about?
So we heard that too, and we generally ask those questions when we're interviewing somebody that is in a narcotic case. We ask what their addiction is, how much they use, and how much they pay for it. For example, our last couple was like a gram a day,
mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, that's a lot.
It's, so you see a greater amount of use?
Yeah, I don't... Like a gram, I would consider a gram a day a lot. I don't know, but I've not used it. But, if you got a, not always do you pay, or they pay $50 a gram. I mean, it's kind of the law of supply and demand. And sometimes they'll pay $100 a gram. Well, it's $100 a day for a person that doesn't have a job, that's got to support that addiction somehow. So that rolls into our stuff with burglaries and larcenies and all that. So, I think it's probably too full. Like, we're seeing, like, weight like we've not seen before coming in. There's 28.5 grams in an ounce. So, I mean, if they're selling that for $50 a gram, it's $1,400 or whatever. So, and they're buying that ounce for $350.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what's good?
Yeah.
So, and these are the numbers that we're just currently getting. So, if they're not a user and they're just a dealer, I mean, there's people that are making money off of that, but generally, what we see is people sell or deal to support their habit. So that's how they do it.
And so you're also seizing quite large amounts compared to what you have seen previously. What sort of quantities are you seizing?
Well, we had one case where it was just under a half a pound of meth. A lot of ounces. I mean, we're dealing mostly in ounces, but we're used to thinking 8-ball, which is what, 3.75 grams?
Yeah, 3 grams.
Used to be a lot. So 3 grams and over in meth is a felony.
Mm-hmm.
So we're pulling, like Rod said, 28 grams here, 44 heat there. I mean, it seems like everything we're dealing with now is in much larger quantities. And I think that is because buying in bulk now is cheaper. I mean, it's easier to get. They don't have to make it. That's another thing, right? So
you're not seeing it domestically made anymore. It's all coming in from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean we have cartel connections?
Yes.
Yeah. Two cases we tied into the cartels from
directly from
one source up. I mean, so yeah, it's the cartels here.
And is that because we're on that lovely arterial transit route, north, south, east, west?
I think that helps.
Yeah, that's part of it.
I think that helps for sure.
But part of it, they're in control of everything.
Just everything.
Yeah, they run absolutely everything. And whether it's...
let's just pause with that. You say everything. What do you mean by everything?
Marijuana, fentanyl, meth.
It's a smorgasbord of drugs.
Are they running other kind of illegal rings to prostitution or...
Child trafficking. Yeah, we have not seen that. I mean, we're educated in that, and we look for it on traffic stops, and we ask the right questions. But we're not seeing a lot of that. Though, that is a crime that is... really hard to get your fingers into and run it out to the end, because they're pretty well educated as well. And
so just because you're not seeing it doesn't mean to say that it's not actually happening.
I would say it is happening for sure, but we just we're not, I suppose, in the right spot at the right time, or I don't know.
A lot needs to come together. You need a lot of cooperation from their victims, so you need a lot of, and a lot of time that's fear based, so they don't want to come out. I mean, for one of the first cases I had when I was here was the hotel case with the stolen car, and we know 110% that those girls were being trafficked, and that took months and months and months. And the issue was they weren't being trafficked here in Buffalo, we just happened to get a hold of them here. Mm-hmm. The crimes were occurring in different jurisdictions in different states, and now I gotta reach out, but we look for it all the time. I mean, we just went to a school not long ago, and so it's definitely in the back of our minds. But to say the cartel is pulling the strings and running the show, I think that's, and even through interviews, lots of interviews, they're even saying the dope isn't as, the meth isn't as strong, but it definitely has fentanyl. So one of the people told us straight up, yeah, I know it's got fentanyl in it because we're trying to quit, and the withdrawals are way worse than they've ever been. They're not what would a normal meth user would be having withdrawals like somebody that's addicted to opiates, but they are, which means that methamphetamine is being mixed or stepped on with some sort of fentanyl.
So those are concerning facts you put out there, that not only are we seeing a lot of meth, which is associated with a lot of issues anyway, both for law enforcement but also for a community. Mm-hmm. And so on, but you're seeing it already mixed with fentanyl to the point that we now have to presume that everything has fentanyl in it. It's not. Yeah. It could be. It now is everything. Do you think that fentanyl is in other things other than meth as well? Is it in weed?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's in weed. It's in pills. What? Oxys. We talk about the, what they call on the street is Mexican blues, and it's those oxys, the blue pills.
And are they here?
They're here.
That's the ones we had, the 1,400 pills.
So just to underscore, if you don't get it from your pharmacist with a bottle with your name on it...
Don't eat it.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, don't eat it. Because like Sean's case with the city where they got the 1,400 pills, those subjects were using fentanyl to... basically go to sleep, and meth to bring them back up again.
So and then marijuana to have an appetite to eat because they weren't eating.
So it was just,
a vicious cycle.
And it's just the weird, hot railing where they melt the pills, inhale the smoke. I mean, it's a nasty, nasty habit.
We've seen, I don't know about what you think, but injecting now, covering a lot
of
needles.
That's a lot.
We were starting to see a lot more intravenous drug use with the needles, and that's just.
And they say that's the threshold. You could probably the people that we talk to, you can smoke it, you can eat it, but when you start to slam it, that's where the beginning of the end.
Slamming being the parochial colloquial for injecting.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you have a new tool that you've been using, the Cellebrite system. Would you explain that?
Yeah, so Cellebrite, Sean and I and Well, the sheriff's office and PD got together, and we got a grant through the Underground Railroad for that program, which is a 3-year program, correct? Mm-hmm. And that was $28,000, something like that. And then DCI jumped on board, gave us the equipment to run that program because it's high speed and takes just a boatload of memory to get everything squared away and installed. And we have leaned on that.
So what does it do?
So computers, cell phone, mainly cell phones, but it can do computers or video games, whatever, anything with a memory, basically. But we mainly use it for cell phones. Cell phones is, nowadays, is everybody's lifeline. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what they use. So we do warrants for information off of cell phones. We take it back to our guys that are trained in that. They plug it in, and what that does is it makes a mirror copy of everything that's on the phone.
Oh, so it basically just draws down,
and it
doesn't just give you a number. Does it give you the message as well?
You pictures, yeah. Deleted pictures,
deleted pictures, and
actual messages, video. I mean, anything that's on your phone. If you were to log into your phone right now, basically, we'll get everything that's on that phone.
And does it work the same for track phones and other devices? So basically, if you have the phone, and I'm assuming that if somebody is arrested and in custody, then the phone becomes.
If we have probable cause to believe that whatever you're arrested for, there's a nexus to that phone.
Right.
So drugs, everybody pretty much does their.
And has this been valuable for you?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I think the most valuable part is the real time. Like, we're dropping that phone off 20 minutes after, 30 minutes after it's done. And we have that information. And then we're moving on that information, like, fast. Versus where we'd have to take it to Gillette or Sheridan or Casper to get it dumped before that. The amount of time in between makes the case is successful. Like, we're getting real-time, you know.
We're just in an interview. So we bring somebody in. They're being processed. While they're being processed, our phone is being dumped. We get the extraction. Now we can have that information when we go back to talk. So we can use that to try to validate whether what they're telling us is true, or we can say, well, I know that's not true because...
And so not only are you able to kind of build some strong, valid evidence of whatever to support the charges that you've brought against them, but I assume you'll also be able to find associates.
Information gathering, for sure.
And what do you see? Do you see that we have kind of huge networks that run across the state of individuals who are all connected in some way?
Yeah, like we... You know, there's a limited amount of locals, I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, generally you run it up to try to get the, you know, the end users, they probably need some help. The people that are slinging pounds in Johnson County, Sean and I want them to go.
Okay, so you're not really interested in necessarily the little guy who's using and maybe dealing a tiny bit of amount on the side. You're interested in the guys that are supplying them more.
We are interested in the people that are dealing. Like, that's, there should be consequences for
do
that.
You think that there's more using and dealing happening together, or are there more dealers than there are users?
I think a dealer is a user.
Most everybody we've dealt with is somehow using at some point, and or a part of it, or when I say using, then maybe they're able to not, you know, they bring people over and, hey, you want to smoke, right? So it's the old, this one's on me, you know. So, hey, look at my stuff. It's better than so-and-so's. You want to smoke? Sure, let's smoke. Or I invite you over and I look at you and they know. I mean, they know the minute somebody walks in whether they use meth or not.
Yeah.
And then they prey on it. And then they say, well, do you guys party? Do you smoke? And then it just goes from there. So it's, but yeah, I mean, we're interested in everybody, even if it's the user that's dealing a little bit. We need to know those folks too.
And we need to stop that.
Yeah.
And part of that process is forced sobriety, mm-hmm. and that's incarceration. So not saying that, that they all need to go to prison for 100 years. We're not saying that. But there's got to be, there's got to be something.
And they've told us before, like, I was waiting. Like,
yeah.
Glad it happened because I can't do it on my own. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, like, we stop it for them. They don't have a choice. And then that gives them time to get sober in jail. And then it's up to them when they get out. But a lot of times, folks will tell us, like, I'm glad it's over. Because and especially lately, because the buzz has been when they come in for me. Because I know I talked to so-and-so and they got locked up.
Okay.
But they can't stop.
Yeah. And like, even a simple user, Kate, like, say, simple user, you know, you have a mom or a dad that are doing meth. The unintended consequences are the kids. And, like, to say that there's no victims for drug use is not, like, it, that's not true. We've done two cases with an endangered child, so.
That raises a question as to, you know, is there a typical meth user in our community? Are there, you know, have we got moms and dads, or are they just young people? Are they, who are they?
Oh, it goes from all ages.
Yeah, all ages.
There's not
60 to 20.
Typical user. I mean, it's, we're seeing that large gamut, and a lot of different people, and a lot of different, some are doing okay, and they can afford to have it because they're doing okay, but it's still.
Yeah, I mean, you can pick the person out. I mean, we were, like, Mary and I went to Casper, Rapid City, 2 weekends ago, and I mean, you can literally see somebody that's spun out on meth. Like, their movements are uncontrolled, and they're, like, they can't stop, and their head's shaking, and it's like.
But is that a longer-term user, or is that somebody who's...
If you take a good bump, you're going to be like that. The long-term user is, you know, we have a term of perma-spun, like, they just can't function anymore. Mm-hmm. Can't string together a sentence. Their addiction is so strong, that's the only thing that they care about. And they, there's nothing that goes above that addiction. As important to them.
And unfortunately, kids get caught in the middle of all of that. And I know you have a very active Child Protective Services unit that works hard to prioritize getting kids to safer spots.
Yeah, a lot of times we respond with Carrie Packard. Mm-hmm. Like, she comes.
They're rock stars.
Yeah.
They do a phenomenal job.
Yeah, we can. I'm not a kid person. I mean, I love kids, but it's just they have that skill set, and
they do a great job.
Yeah, patience maybe is the word. I don't know how you do it, but you know, we all have our roles, and we're just so lucky that everybody works together. Like, it's from the county attorney's office, PD, SO, DFS, DCI, Highway Patrol. Like, you know, it's I don't even want to talk about it because I don't want it to change. Because we're so successful at what we're doing right now. But, I'll add this. Like, if nobody's this media glory hound, we go places. Where we start losing it is the person that takes off on his own or her mm-hmm. own. And, you know, this is my case. This is what I done. You won't see us doing that. So.
It's a team effort for sure.
Yeah. It's not one, it's everyone.
And it's like, how can I help? I mean, sometimes mm-hmm. it's overwhelming when it's your case and you come back and you have, seriously, like a table full of evidence, and evidence in its own right is just, mm-hmm. and then you have 2.5-hour interviews that you have to get together. You have the report to write, the affidavit to write, and everybody walks in and says, what can I do? So, mm-hmm. You know, I'm measuring drugs and packaging evidence and type of interviews.
So we have a time limit. Like, right. From the time we arrest somebody on a felony, we have to have an affidavit done within 72 hours. 72 hours sounds like a lot, but it's not. You're scrambling. You're still gathering evidence. And, like, it's we're pushed against that timeline a lot. So
we may do one, and then we find out we have to go on the information we have. We have okay, to go you, to the other
you're
one.
You're pulling the thread and finding things that are going on.
It's like, okay, we got to hit this one. So, hey, you stay here, get your affidavit done, we'll roll and get this started. Now, all of a sudden, you have two. And so it gets to be, so it doesn't matter whether you're the chief, the sheriff, an officer, or an investigator, under sheriff.
So switching gears somewhat, the nation has seen in the last, certainly several years, a significant uptick in mass shooting events. And they don't seem to be slowing down, they don't seem to be stopping, and a number of them do seem to be happening in a school setting. Only yesterday, an incident in Denver where two staff were shot. The shooter was actually later found in his vehicle, apparently has committed suicide and so on. But the randomness and the unpredictability, I think, is very concerning. What has been happening in Johnson County to prepare for the horrific thought that that incidents could happen here?
Well, we just recently had another TAC 1 training. Charles,
Mr. Oski, yes, the superintendent.
Yep, mm-hmm. He is like super proactive and getting stuff squared away and inviting law enforcement. All of our officers went through that training. We just went to another, I don't even know what that's called.
School safety.
Yeah.
Partnership.
Yeah. So, to try to identify the kids that are struggling, or I guess so we're all in the know and everybody knows.
So it's not just you as law enforcement agents knowing what you would do should you get the call or should you get a notification that there is a significant issue in hand or an incident in progress in the school. You're already actively working with others within the community to kind of identify individual students or anyone really who might be struggling and feeling that that is the solution to their mm-hmm. problem.
Yeah, and I think that's like one way you could be proactive is, and give a lot of credit to Charles because he's put together this, like not only the TAC 1, but this other, what did you call it?
The School Safety Partnership.
Yeah, so it's DFS, it's the county attorneys, it's the school, it's, I mean, there's a lot of people involved in that. And, you know, I liken it to a very well, like it could, where the information sharing is going out. Mm-hmm. Like if there is a, something that law enforcement's seeing, we're going to probably get a hold of that and see what information the school has and how that matches up. And if it's truly a concern or if it's a bump in a road for that child, but where everybody is at least in the know on people that kids, you know, we say, you know, not always is it a kid, it's adults too, but if there are concerning behaviors and if there's any information any other partner has, they're going to kick that to the team. So at least we can kind of know.
So do you as law enforcement agencies, do you have a plan for exactly what would swing into action? Have you rehearsed that? Have you been through additional trainings?
Yeah, so we, yeah. Well, number one, everybody's going. Number two, the first one that gets there is going in. Like we're not going to wait for brass or wait for, like they're going in. That's
doesn't matter if it's in the city or county.
Yeah.
It's whoever gets there. We've, you know, identified different, I don't want to put too much out there, but we've identified different, what's our central command going to be? What's it going to look like? What happens if it's an area where you don't have service? And, you know, where's our emergency personnel going to stage? And that kind of stuff, because that's huge too. You know, how is the message going to get out to parents? Where are they going to stage? I mean, there's a lot to be dealt with that. And part of that school safety partnership with the communication is going back to the drug cases when the children are involved, that affects the children. So if they go to school and they're not right and something is, like we let the school know, hey, look, we just had this case. If you know, little Johnny's not the same person, this could be a reason why. So they're not concerned to call on us or they don't know that we were dealing with the parent. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And so that goes in the same thing if there's a school threat, you know, regardless of But we get a lot of calls on it, and we follow up every one as if it was a real threat until we determine that it's not.
Okay. And, of course, you know, to add to that, all students in all schools have been through active shooter response trainings as well. So, and they've had 2 years of what is a three-year program. So, you know, it seems that there is a much more joined up, ready, aware, trained response in place should the unthinkable happen here.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is that as far as like our law enforcement then, it's like what's expected of law enforcement. It's, you know, Evaldi kind of showed that, you know, they waited, well, it was obvious they waited too long, and that was through supervisors or whatever. Here in our community, in Johnson County, the first one is in, like it's not. You know, a question was asked on the radio last time, like from the patrol guy, like, should I go in? And it's like, it's made clear that,
yeah,
should, like, you're going in. So we're not gonna wait. And I understand. I mean, and when you, like, everybody's response is going to be different. Cops are humans too, and they're all going to have a different, like, everybody can talk a big show until it's time, you know. So,
but the training plays a role in that too. And, you know, the more you train, the more your reflex, especially if you train in an adrenalized state, the more your reflex kicks in that is your response, and you don't pause.
Muscle memory for sure.
Yeah.
You have something to revert to.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that was, like, the first TAC-1 training, that was super good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it took you to your stress level, and then you debriefed afterwards, and, you know, why did you do this or why didn't you do that? And people were talking about, everybody thinks a little different, but everybody's the same with the searches and how it's searched and when you make contact and if, you know, if there's a suspect. Like, those things are all, you know what to do, but to put it in that high stress spot, it's going to change with everybody.
So, bottom line is that parents in the community should feel reassured that we are as ready as we probably ever could be.
Absolutely.
I think so. I think we've done more training with the school than since I've been here. But and everybody's going, like all the deputies, all the PD guys, like they're going to these trainings. And our last one was on casualties and how to address that and how to...
after the shooting.
Yeah, after the shooting. Right. The tourniquets,
what
you do with victims and where they go and all. Like, it was, these last two have been really, really well put together through TAC-1.
I actually met with the church security team so that we know what, you know, a lot of our churches now have security teams. And so it was good to meet with them because of, what is your plan? So when we show up, what is your protocol as a security team in a church? Are your doors locked? Is the side door open? How are you reacting to what's going on inside? Even asked, well, what kind of information do we give the 911? You know, so for us to know, hey, so they know when they call 911, this is the information that we need. Who's the good guys? Who's the bad guys? What's the good guys wearing? Because the last thing you want is a, you know, blue on blue kind of thing. So just simple things like that. So he can go back, tell his team, well, this is what the police are expecting. This is what they're going to expect when they show up. And so that's not just schools. We've seen...
Yes, there have been mass shootings in grocery stores. I think we're almost on the anniversary of the King Soopers shooting in Boulder.
So, you know, that goes not just for the schools. I think we're prepared better than we ever are for anywhere in the community, but especially the schools, obviously. Yeah.
Well, that's very good to hear. Thank you for the reassurance. Thank you for a very interesting conversation about what is happening in drugs and your policing efforts here in Johnson County, and also about mass shootings and that situation. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.